Speaker, Mr. Bruce Hafen, knows whereof he speaks. He has been married since 1964 and has seven children, as his vita tells us, as of March 1st, 1981. What happens on June 1st, no one knows. He has a background in law and is currently the president of Ricks College in Rexburg, Idaho, a Mormon college with 6,500 students. He is subject to some constraint, he told me the other night, in the fact that he would really continue love and his plans to return back to his law teaching, but the Mormon Church assigns people presidencies of colleges against their subjective preferences, I guess we might say. He is on the board of academic advisors to the American Family Institute and has published numerous articles on the family, children, and the law. Mr. Hafen.
At the end of a long day, which has nevertheless been very stimulating, I'm sorry I can't be as electrifying here as I was the other night in Eugene, Oregon, but you'll just have to live with that. I've always wanted to be that electrifying from a pulpit. I was in the hometown of a basketball player named Danny Ainge, of whom you may have heard, who plays for Brigham Young University, where I am on the law faculty at times. I was there for a meeting related to the work of my college and the church, and it was kind of a religious gathering of sorts on a weeknight, and it so happened that after that gathering had been scheduled, a game was scheduled between two great universities in this country, Notre Dame and Brigham Young. And with my interest in religion, I told that crowd that you'd have to be an atheist not to be interested in the outcome of that game. Especially in view of the previous football game in the Holiday Bowl between Brigham Young and Southern Methodist. I don't know why it all seems to happen that way. That night, one of the local church leaders asked if it wouldn't be possible, since this is Danny Ainge's hometown and these people all know him, could we just kind of tell them the score during the talk I'm to give, because they'd really all rather be out listening on their radios. And I agreed, since I wanted to know the score too. And as particularly toward the end, as we were giving the countdown with the score and the minutes left, tied a game as it was, right at the end, as I prepared to tell them that their hometown boy had, with a great razzle-dazzle play, made the winning basket, I had that audience eating out of the palm of my hand. And may never have that experience again. It could be said of me that night, as it was said of the cross-eyed javelin thrower, well, he didn't break any records, but he sure kept the crowd awake. I must say to you, however, lest you be concerned, that out at Brigham Young, we are concerned about the theoretical underpinnings of which the senator spoke today, and I want you to know that we're trying to make a university out there of which the football and basketball teams can be proud, and we think we can do it. Oh, one last thing I should tell you before getting into my talk is that you probably have never heard of Ricks College or Rexburg, Idaho, which is very near the Tetons and Yellowstone Park. But I should tell you also that the Philadelphia Society isn't exactly a household word in Rexburg. This week, some of the people with whom I work knew I was leaving to go somewhere, and one of them said to me just the other day, when do you leave for Philadelphia? And I said, I'm going to Chicago. And she said, I thought it was the Philadelphia Society. I said, well, it is, but they meet in Chicago. It's the Chicago Society that meets in Philadelphia. And so she was reassured to know of those two great societies. Last December, New York's highest court reversed the convictions of three homosexuals who had committed certain sex acts in violation of a state law. The court said the law interfered with the defendant's constitutional right, quote, to seek sexual gratification from what was once commonly regarded as deviant conduct, end of quote. A few weeks later, a United States congressman from Mississippi resigned in disgrace after being arrested in a Washington men's room for committing those same acts. The difference in outcome between these two incidents reflects a vast gulf of confusion in this country. That confusion is a significant factor in any contemporary discussion about the family and the law. The topic suggested for me was, should the family, like national defense and religion, qualify for preferential status within the legal system? At the outset, we should note that the family does now and has long since enjoyed special protections within the American legal system. Scattered throughout the statutory and common law sources of state law, we find such concepts as marital interests in real property, privileged communications between husband and wife, inheritance rights belonging to family survivors under intestate succession laws, and wrongful death rights in tort law. For instance, the relational interest among family members creates the right to sue for injury to that relationship when a family member is killed. But by contrast, business corporations would not ordinarily have a similar right to sue for the wrongful death of even a key man, nor could one sue for the loss of a close friend. At the level of constitutional law, the Supreme Court has created an impressive array of protections for family relationships, despite the absence of any mention of the family in the text of the Constitution. As early as 1888, the Supreme Court described marriage as, quote, the most important relation in life and the foundation of the family and of society, without which there would be neither civilization nor progress. In 1923, in Meyer versus Nebraska, the court gave constitutional status to the right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children without undue state interference. That's still good law, subject to some qualifications. The court first recognized the constitutional right of privacy in 1965 as an inherent characteristic of marriage, which the court called, quote, intimate to the degree of being sacred, end of quote. In a series of cases since 1965, the court has gone on to establish a constitutional right to marry. This right, for example, bars the state from forbidding interracial marriages. There is nonetheless a growing sense of doubt today about the family's place in our hierarchy of national values. This uneasiness seems to arise not in spite of the family's traditional status, but in part because of that very status. In this time of fully flowered egalitarianism, the very existence of a legal preference makes everybody want to qualify for it. Thus, the phrase, all in the family, may be far too true these days as an expression of non-discriminatory sentiment. Example, at the Baltimore session of last year's White House Conference on the Family, a homosexual delegate asked the conference to define the family as, quote, two or more persons who share resources, responsibility for decisions, values, and goals, and have commitment to one another over time, end of quote. That proposal lost by 2 votes among 671 delegates. As this incident suggests, the very definition of the family was the most divisive issue in that national conference on the family. Thus, Stanley Hauerwas has said, the real crisis with American family life today is our inability to define what kind of family should exist and why we should think of it as our most basic moral institution, end of quote. For this reason, in view of the law's historical preference for the family, a more basic issue than continuing the legal preference would be, what is a family for legal purposes? The family is not the only non-negotiable issue to surprise us by suddenly appearing to be negotiable in these bewildering times. Some of you will remember that Dallin Oaks told this same group a year ago that the Supreme Court has defined the free exercise of religion under the First Amendment to mean, essentially, the free exercise of philosophy, religious, anti-religious, or otherwise. The enormous problem with defining special categories to include almost everything is, as Judge Oaks noted, that the much-prized category itself becomes meaningless. Especially for you somehow becomes especially for anybody. Alexander Solzhenitsyn has described our general sense of contemporary vagueness in these terms. We are approaching a major turning point in the history of civilization. It is a juncture at which settled concepts suddenly become hazy, lose their precise contours. It's the sort of turning point where the hierarchy of values which we have venerated and which we use to determine what is important to us is starting to rock and may collapse. End of quotation. It may be impossible to understand the real causes of our confusion about what it means to belong to a family. Surely there are social causes as well as legal ones, and these causes may reach far into the dimly lit past. Robert Nisbet believes the currents of modern social change affecting the family originated more than a century ago as part of a general development Nisbet calls the twilight of authority. Similarly, Christopher Lash has provided a provocative analysis for his view that during the past 100 years, society itself has taken over the socialization process that traditionally belonged to the family. But because social institutions simply cannot do what families do, we have weakened tremendously the capacity of our people for self-direction and self-control. In addition, he says, we have undermined one of the principal sources of social cohesion. Well, with such large-scale forces at work, it doesn't seem fair, perhaps, to blame the law for emerging weaknesses in the American commitment to traditional family structures, except insofar as the law reflects social change. I'm reminded here of the cartoon I saw recently showing a wise-looking rooster looking down at an innocent little chick, and the rooster was saying, in your case, son, it was the egg that came first. That may also be true in the relationship here between social change and legal change. At the same time, as Arthur Shenfield was saying earlier today, the pervasive legal structure that reflects the family tradition has the power to support that tradition to a significant extent. If our grip on the family has weakened, the law may have been at least a willing partner. And yet, part of my purpose today is to show that our legal institutions remain, in a day of uncertainty, relatively certain about what a family is for the most fundamental purposes. I hope the law can clarify even more the meaning of those terms, because in a peculiarly important sense, and this was the part that that Arthur made so well today, the law is the last bastion of resistance to the currents that would obliterate the meaning of the family as we know it. And that is because one of the law's oldest and most significant functions is to protect society from a capricious yielding to its own darkest urges, at least until a majority of the people consciously and deliberately choose to alter the framework on which our cultural foundations rest. Unfortunately, there are too many in our day, including members of the judiciary, who would use the potent tools of constitutional law to change these foundations in a misguided exercise of minority rule. I would now like to illustrate my view that, despite the gains of individualism in recent years, our most authoritative legal institutions have not abandoned the traditional elements of family relationships. I find enough confusion in the literature on this point that I want to be very pointed in stating that premise, and I have some explanation about it. These elements that I call the basic ones of a traditional family relationship include the concept of formal marriage, the concept of minority status, and the concept of heterosexual intimacy within marriage, manifested positively by the Supreme Court's view of sexual privacy in marriage, and negatively by laws against fornication, adultery, and homosexual conduct. I'll then mention a few instances that reflect a weakening of the supports for these fundamental elements, because that is happening too. And then I'll close with some reference to the need for greater clarity concerning the procedural issues and the social policies that underlie our legal definitions. To say a word then about where the law is, and you'll note that the law is more certain about some fundamentals than the people were at the White House Conference on Families. No state, as far as I know, today, would knowingly issue a marriage license to a pair of homosexuals, although, on the authority of that New York case I mentioned, decided only last December, about sexual privacy for homosexuals, a family court at the county level in New York, just about a month ago, permitted a 22-year-old male homosexual to adopt as his child his 26-year-old male live-in companion. That's the first case of that kind that I know of, the closest thing I've seen to a family relationship. That would not happen in other jurisdictions in this country, any of them. That's important. Moreover, unmarried heterosexual couples are not regarded as families for the many purposes addressed by state family law statutes, even in those states that have recognized limited contractual claims between couples like Lee and Michelle Marvin. And despite expansive language in some early opinions, the actual decisions, holdings of the Supreme Court that touch upon legally protected relationships and familial interests do not depart from the traditional Census Bureau definition of family, persons related by blood, marriage, or adoption. A complete summary and analysis of the relevant cases must wait for another day. There are many cases, but I'm satisfied that marriage and kinship can still be regarded as the touchstones of constitutional adjudication in family-related cases, including those dealing with sexual privacy. The court has limited certain aspects of the policy favoring marital status, but it's done so only in an effort to remedy exceptional cases of injustice or inequity. And even the exceptional issues have been treated in such a way that constitutional protection has not yet been extended to relationships between unmarried adults. For example, the cases giving constitutional guarantees to illegitimate children have recognized only the relationship between a child and an unwed parent, never the relationship between the two parents. Similarly, the recent cases recognizing the constitutional interest of certain unwed fathers have only sought to equalize for fathers the long-standing position of the law with respect to unwed mothers. For centuries, the law has discouraged sex outside marriage, yet we've not been willing to terminate the parental rights of an unwed mother on the grounds that her conduct has made her, per se, an unfit parent. Our attitudes were captured more than a century ago in Nathaniel Hawthorne's classic story of the unwed mother, The Scarlet Letter. Hester Prynne was brought before the Puritan leaders to hear whether her child would be taken from her in view of her moral transgression. After serious deliberations, they let her keep the baby. Said one of them, quote, "Is there not a quality of awful sacredness in the relation between this mother and this child?" End of quote. The recognition of parental rights in such a case arises from the law's respect for kinship, which exists despite the law's preference that kinship arise out of marriage. But I repeat, the relationship between two adults living together is not kinship, and it is not marriage, and the law has not recognized it at the level of constitutional protection. One other line of cases in the early 1970s before the Supreme Court appeared to create a constitutional right of privacy that might eventually protect sexual relations outside marriage under such First Amendment headings as freedom of expression or freedom of intimate association. Such a right has not, in fact, developed. The court has refused to recognize in several cases recently the broad rights of personal privacy once forcefully advocated by the late Justice William O. Douglas. A bit of unfortunate judicial language in some of the court's contraception and abortion cases has permitted some commentators to infer that sexual privacy between unmarried persons may be constitutionally protected. The New York case to which I referred mistakenly interprets the Supreme Court in just that way. However, those cases, the Supreme Court cases, have expressly limited themselves to a single woman's decision to prevent conception or to have an abortion. The court has grouped these cases with others that recognize the kinship rights of parents. The cases can thus be viewed as granting constitutional protection not to a single woman's relational interest with her sexual partner, but to her potential relational interest with her own offspring. This interpretation is supported by the court's refusal in several cases to extend constitutional protection to sex acts between unmarried persons. In view of these decisions, I've been disturbed that some lower courts and much of the existing commentary in the legal journals interpret the Supreme Court as having removed the basis for legal discrimination between the married and the unmarried statuses. A great deal of misunderstanding has been caused by the court's own use of individualistic civil rights theories and rhetoric in dealing with family policy problems. The court has been swayed by the prevailing currents of egalitarianism in conceptualizing and talking about the problems it has faced, even though when you read the cases carefully and see what the results are, you find the justices have often sensed instinctively the destructive impact that full-blown individual rights theories would have had on the obligations inherent in the family tradition. In the midst of the court's theoretical ambiguity, however, there has been ample room for the permissive bias of many commentators to have a field day. In addition, some interpreters with a more traditional bias have been so alarmed by some of the court's language that they have read more into the actual decisions than I consider warranted, finding there the death of marriage and other similar calamities. I fear that overreactions such as these can too easily become self-fulfilling prophecies, because lower courts are influenced more by the commentary on the cases, so it appears, than they are by the cases themselves. Taken together, the Supreme Court's cases simply do not justify the conclusion that the constitutional rights associated with marriage and kinship are available to homosexuals and unmarried couples. That observation is very important for lawyers and judges to remember. It may also be important for anyone seeking to understand where the law is in defining or redefining the meaning of preferred family relationships. At the same time, a number of other legal developments have clearly weakened the indirect supports for traditional family bonds. The picture would be less than complete without a few illustrations. The divorce reform movement, which began by distinguishing between personal fault and actual breakdown of a marriage, has now created in some states the practical right of unilateral marriage termination. In unilateral action, neither the interests of the marital partner nor society's interest in marital continuity are adequately considered. The war on poverty has created a series of welfare laws that provide incentives for informal cohabitation and illegitimate children, thereby encouraging among the poor a matriarchal society in which fathers are discouraged from assuming either economic or social responsibility for their children. The growth of permissive attitudes toward criminal law reform has encouraged the legislative removal of legal sanctions against sexual misconduct on the unproven theory that such crimes are victimless. And as Professor Burns has indicated, the Supreme Court's obscenity decisions and its extension of constitutional rights to single persons and minors in such sensitive areas as abortion and contraception have clearly created the impression of a looser moral climate, thereby undermining many traditional norms. Yet it would be unfair to imply that these developments are caused by deliberate antipathy toward family-centered values. Each of these policy adjustments has advanced some interest, at least arguably worthy of legal protection, despite the conflict between that interest and the legal preference for formal family ties. At the same time, the aggregate effect of so many specific changes is to diminish the significance of the family tradition in this society and to make our once settled concepts about the very definition of marriage and the family appear hazy. I think it not too far-fetched to view this pattern of change as a kind of forest fire burning its way through a variety of indirect support systems for traditional family norms whipped by the winds of the individual liberation movements. The previously mentioned position of the Supreme Court on those basic elements of marriage, minority status, and sexual privacy stand as something of a natural firebreak that limits how far and how fast the blaze can move. I consider it absolutely crucial that this firebreak be maintained, for beyond it, there is nothing to stop the charring of our traditional concepts beyond recognition. I'd now like to mention one issue that could significantly affect whether the line of legal development is held at that firebreak, namely, whether the burden of proof is to be shifted. That may sound lawyer-like and unimportant, but it's extremely important in this context. Let me try to explain. Until the civil rights movement, our customary social practices, reflected in our laws as well as our cultural assumptions, were, in effect, innocent until proven guilty. The judicial decisions of the civil rights era changed all that. The undeniable evidence of man's inhumanity to man and the attitudes and practices of some Americans on the race issue had become such a blight on the national conscience that we resorted to far-reaching changes in our constitutional theory as it applies to personal civil rights. A constitutional test emerged that had the effect of presuming certain kinds of laws were suspect until proven pure in their application to personal rights. I refer to what the court calls the compelling state interest test and other tests having the same procedural effect. These subtle yet profound constitutional developments were originally designed to remedy only the extraordinary abuses of racial discrimination that seemed to defy more conventional solutions. They were a cure for cancer. Once invented and popularized, however, they were seized upon by every would-be healer of a social illness and pressed upon the Supreme Court with overwhelming and often irresistible intensity. It's now fair to wonder whether the medicine is a greater threat than the illnesses. The abortion cases decided in 1973 illustrate vividly how the new constitutional test works. The overriding issue in those cases was, when does life begin? If fetal life were thought to begin in the early stages of pregnancy, the obvious interests of an unborn child would have prevented the legalizing of non-therapeutic abortions. If, on the other hand, life were thought to begin at some later stage, a pregnant woman's private choice about abortion could be constitutionally protected. Unfortunately, nobody knew in 1973, and nobody knows now, at least not in any demonstrable scientific sense, exactly when life begins. And the absence of empirical proof, an assumption about the nature of life and when it begins had to be made. The state legislatures that passed the anti-abortion laws at issue in Roe versus Wade had obviously made their own factual assumptions in favor of fetal life, an assumption with which I happen to agree. Under traditional tests of constitutional law, the Supreme Court would have deferred to this legislative finding of fact. In the abortion cases, however, the court began with the premise that a pregnant woman has a constitutional right of privacy. A line of precedent cases since 1965 had already determined that the compelling state interest test applied to privacy cases. In classifying abortion, then, as a privacy issue, the court shifted to the state the burden of proving the fetus was alive. This the state could not prove, just as opposing counsel could not prove the fetus was not alive. Thus, the court made a factual assumption in the absence of concrete evidence that a fetus is not a person. With tremendous irony, the court's majority opinion modestly stated it was not determining when life begins. Technically, that statement was correct, but letting the new constitutional test shift the burden of proof had precisely the same practical effect as if the court had determined there is in fact no life prior to the third trimester. I place such emphasis on this issue because of the enormous implications of shifting the burden of proof in a lawsuit from those who challenge an existing tradition to those who would sustain it. For one thing, it is simply not possible, now or ever, either to prove or disprove conclusively the social or moral value of many normative presuppositions that underlie our culture. Much can be demonstrated, but much cannot. As a result, the placing of the burden of proof in such cases will often determine the outcome. If that burden is placed on the state, the legal meaning of family will be defined just as life was defined in the abortion cases, not by evidence or even by analysis, but by an arbitrary shift of theoretical assumptions. The judiciary is thereby allowed to change the most fundamental patterns of our social character with no proof whatever that the change will be for the better or in the long run even tolerable. A striking example is the case I mentioned at the outset for the New York Court of Appeals to determine that the right of privacy applied to acts between homosexuals may have seemed unrelated to family. It was only weeks after that that a county court in that same state decided that one homosexual could adopt another even when both were adults in light of the authority about their sexual privacy. C.S. Lewis once wrote, "Wherever any precept of traditional morality is simply challenged to produce its credentials as though the burden of proof lay on it, we have taken the wrong position. The legitimate reformer endeavors to show that the precept in question conflicts with some precept which its defenders allow to be more fundamental, or that it does not really embody the judgment of value it professes to embody. The direct frontal attack, why? What good does it do? Who said so? Is never permissible. Not because it is harsh or offensive, but because no values at all can justify themselves on that level. If you persist in that kind of trial, you will destroy all values and so destroy the bases of your own criticism as well as the thing being criticized." End of quote. Similarly, James Hitchcock has written, quote, "A traditional way of life is one which takes its practical authority from custom itself, from the instinctive sense of the rightness of things which a genuinely traditional community inculcates in its members. The tree can grow because its roots are not being constantly yanked out of the ground for examination. But this settled way of life is, because of the very conditions which make it possible, highly vulnerable to attack. Skepticism can dissolve existing bonds with relative ease, even when it is powerless to create new ones. If objections to a novel position, such as homosexuality as merely an alternative lifestyle, if the objections to that cannot be easily stated and concretely demonstrated, then it is assumed mere prejudice governs the objectors." End of quotation. In his work on the philosophy of knowledge, Michael Polanyi has advanced an insightful explanation of why precise explanations of tradition are hard to come by. In discussing the concept of skills as a field of personal knowledge, Polanyi begins with the premise that, quote, "The aim of a skillful performance is achieved by the observance of a set of rules which are not known as such to the person following them." As illustrations, Polanyi considers swimming, bicycling, and then more sophisticated scientific practices. He notes that many significant characteristics in the practice of an art are simply unspecifiable, even though general theoretical guidelines may be useful when integrated with practical experience. As a result, he says, "An art which cannot be specified in detail cannot be transmitted by prescription, since no prescription for it exists. It can be passed on only by example from master to apprentice. By watching the master and emulating his efforts in the presence of his example, the apprentice unconsciously picks up the rules of the art, including those which are not explicitly known to the master himself. These hidden rules can be assimilated only by a person who surrenders himself to that extent uncritically to the imitation of another. A society which wants to preserve a fund of personal knowledge must submit to tradition. End of quote. In an example relevant to the functions of law, Polanyi cites the development in 17th and 18th century British life of both a political art and a political doctrine. Quote, the art, which embodied the exercise of public liberties, was naturally unspecifiable. And the doctrines of political liberty were maxims of this art which could be properly understood only by those skilled in the art. The doctrines of political freedom spread from England in the 18th century to France and thence throughout the world, while the unspecifiable art of exercising public liberty, being communicable only by a tradition, was not transmitted with the doctrine. End of quote. This observation offers some explanation of why the political theory of democracy does not always bear practical fruit when transplanted as a set of slogans to cultures in which traditional practices do not reflect the unenforceable and unspecifiable customary assumptions on which successful democracy rests. The civil rights era gave birth to the iconoclastic mindset which demands the abandonment of traditional practices as mere prejudice unless specific justification is forthcoming. This attitude was moved to its adolescence by the breathless anti-authoritarianism of the late 60s. It has found its greatest expression in the courts, because basic constitutional theory permits the majoritarian traditions reflected in legislation to be discarded overnight by the judiciary when basic civil rights are allegedly threatened. Unfortunately, as once said by Mr. Justice Harlan Fiske Stone, through judicial interpretation, the constitutional device for the protection of minorities from oppressive majority action may be made the means by which the majority is subjected to the tyranny of the minority. It was the lasting contribution of Justice Holmes that saw clearly the danger arose not from the want of appropriate formulas for the exercise of the judicial function, but from judicial distrust of the democratic process. End of quote. This discussion is relevant to the very specific procedural issue of burden of proof in the constitutional adjudication of family-related issues. Given the current egalitarian momentum, the Supreme Court could, though it has thus far declined to do so, adopt John Stuart Mill's principle that the state may not regulate individual conduct unless the state carries the burden of showing the conduct is demonstrably harmful. A few state courts, such as the one in New York, have already done that. In that event, state laws discriminating between married and unmarried persons or laws restricting the sexual privacy of singles and homosexuals would probably be unconstitutional because compelling evidence that moral permissiveness is either beneficial or harmful is virtually impossible to adduce. I stress that such evidentiary limitations arise primarily from the inability of social science research to demonstrate what Polanyi would call the unspecifiable elements in our cultural traditions. Thus, the a priori decision of where to place the burden of proof will determine the outcome. If I were to illustrate this point by drawing a little cartoon, I'd show a bloody and tattered lawyer standing in rags before a judge whose desk and chambers were a pile of rubble. Holding up a few shreds of paper, the lawyer would say, "Now I think I can show, Your Honor, that those practices were harmful to society." Well, I had another word or two to say. In the interest of time, I'll just collapse that quickly. Even though it's difficult to prove conclusively, as I've suggested, and therefore the burden of proof issue is so important, at the same time, the mindset of our age demands, ladies and gentlemen, that we become far more articulate than we have been in explaining the social policies underlying the family tradition. The scholarly work on individual rights fills volume upon volume. But family patterns, universally accepted before the dawn of law and government, haven't seemed to require full-dress justification. I have looked in vain, I have talked with others who have looked in vain, to find anything more than platitudes and cliches explaining why society is justified in restricting sexual privacy to marriage and so many other things related to the family. I would invite any of you to share with me, and my address is in the list of people attending this conference, any information regarding literature on this subject. There are so many things. Just quickly, an example or two. It has seemed so obvious it hasn't been documented, but some sense of a formal long-term family commitment is absolutely crucial to the developmental needs of children. But that issue is rarely treated in contemporary literature about open marriage and informal cohabitation, either for or against. Another basic issue is that concepts such as marriage, kinship, and minority status have tremendous jurisprudential significance throughout the socioeconomic structure. As Paul Johnson said, legal certainty is the basis of investment and capital formation. At the heart of any stable law of property is a clear and universal legal doctrine of marriage, legitimacy, and inheritance. That deserves to be explicated fully. It has not yet been. The unarticulated policy roots of family law are also directly related to the larger ends of a democratic society, because it is primarily through family bonds that both children and parents learn the meaning of that concept so critical to the existence of an open society, obedience to the unenforceable. Here again, there is very, very little literature available. Walter Byrne's work on this subject is an excellent example of what needs to be done. Much, much more will be necessary. As someone has said, before we take down a fence, let us at least understand why it was put there in the first place. I trust that all of us will do our part to increase understanding of that kind. As we do so, we will also do our part to encourage in American society an attitude we first discover in our own homes. He ain't heavy, he's my brother. Thank you.